From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white.
I think my mother knew that I would eventually go, but she was dreading the day when I actually would. So I remember walking into the kitchen and saying to her, "Mom, I've applied for Lebanon." And she just cried.
From a distance, there is harmony, and it echoes through the land.
Even in typing out the letter, I was saying, "I don't know if I can do this." So I let it go through and went ahead. But as I knew, I was getting the feedback that, yes, you're due the trip, and I was getting jittery. I didn't know how to react. I knew I was going to get it and I was due it, and yet I said, "No, maybe I won't, whatever." So I was told officially then that I got the trip, and I couldn't believe it. I didn't know whether I was sad or whether I was happy. I knew I would do it eventually. And I said, "Right, this is it. I'm going to have to do it. And if I don't like it, that's just tough. That's life. I'll have to handle it."
From a distance, we are instruments marching in a common band, playing songs of hope, playing songs of peace. They're the songs of every man.
After I left school, I actually applied for the army while I was still in school, just before leaving cert. I sat my leaving cert actually in uniform. And at that stage, we were just in the initial training stage. And we had 40 girls thrown together into a billet. Most of us didn't have army affiliations at all. I was very lucky in that I've an army background and I knew exactly, or more or less, what I was heading into. My army background, my father was in the army band, and most of my uncles were in the army. Both my grandfathers were in the army. So it just came from generation to generation. And of course, the fact it was a new thing was really appealing as well, that we were going to be the first females in the Irish Army, which was marvellous, a great feeling. First day we went up, and I didn't know what to wear because I was going into a place where I was going to be given uniforms or whatever, so I decided I'd doll myself up anyway. So we went up and we went into this room, and these four girls were sitting there and looking at me, and they were just near to tears. And I said, "What's going on here?" And they said, "Oh, we've been down to our medical and there was people looking at us, and we had to give urine samples and we had to do these awful things." And I hadn't been at that stage. So I said, "Oh no, I can't face this on my own. There's nobody coming with me." So they sent an NCO who was in charge of the training down with me. And I came into the hospital down there, which is very military. And there was uniforms everywhere. And there was I dressed up in my little frillies and whatever. But I mean, all eyes were on the one female in the room who had just come in. And I just couldn't wait to get out of there. And most people from the Curra and general area were together, billeted together. We didn't know each other very well. But the first thing we were shown was how to make up our bed. So we thought, you make up a bed by just throwing up the bed covers. But no, there was a special way to make up the bed. And we couldn't believe this. As neat and tidy as we were, this was just, we couldn't believe this. Everything was a centimetre this way and a centimetre that way. And so this was really, we ended up just laughing about it all, because that's basically what gets you through. So within about a week, you automatically just are in tune with what's going on. But I had very long hair, and it was down my back, and I thought it was lovely. I thought I was really nice. So I came out on parade next morning with my black beret sitting on top of this wild hair. And I thought I looked really nice. So the first thing I was told was, "Go, get your hair cut." So I panicked and I got it skint right up. I was just like a boy. I panicked so much. And I think everybody did. They could have said, "Jump off the building," and I'd say, "Okay, fine." You were just so scared. and yet excited about the whole thing, that it didn't really matter. And just to learn about aspects that I had never known about, even with a military background, to know how to use a weapon and to know I could be in control of a weapon and to know how to move tactically in a certain area, it was all very, very exciting. The terrible things really were, I suppose, the miserable days that we had to go out. I mean, hail, rain or snow, we just had to go and that was it. And that was the miserable side of things, probably. And all the shouting, like, I could never understand, why are they shouting at me? I can hear them. But this is just the way it is. And, you know, but particularly for the civvies, that was very funny because they were just completely, why is he doing this to me? I didn't do anything, you know, that kind of an attitude. But probably that was the whole fear, and just the fear that maybe I won't make it, maybe I won't be finally approved or whatever, maybe I just don't fit in here. And but there was always the friendship there that said, look, if you're weak on this, we're going to get you through. I think my mother knew that I would eventually go, but she was dreading the day when I actually would. So I remember walking into the kitchen and saying to her, Mom, I've applied for Lebanon. And she just cried. She just got so upset because I'm the oldest of the girls at home and we're very close.
I knew Sharon had applied and I knew that this time she definitely would have been going because she wanted to go so badly. And I said, this is it this time. And I'm delighted for her, really, but very lonely. I really am delighted for Sharon because it's something she wanted to do and she's really into her career in a big way. And I think now is the right time for her to go, really. And I'm delighted for her because we didn't get those opportunities. So I'm very, very happy for her that way. But we will miss her terrible because she's very close-knit altogether. And she's at home every day for her lunch with me. So, and then you worry, is she going to be all right? And that kind of thing, you know.
But does that really scare you? I mean, do you think about the fact that she actually might get injured? Or
yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think that if things go wrong out there, that, like, I suppose when you hear these things on the radio and you're not personally linked to it, you don't give it that much thought. But it's different when you have somebody belong to you out there. We're all behind her, really. You know, at the back of it all, we'll miss her, but we're happy for her, you know, that she is going.
I was delighted and very pleased when she was selected to go. She was the last of her class of girls to be selected. And for that reason, I was delighted she got to serve her country and we'll miss her very much, of course, when she goes. It's a very tense situation, very tense there at the moment, and there could be a spillover from the Gulf crisis and, you know, it coming up to Christmas time and it's family time, more important than that, and we'll miss her, you know.
Sharon, what does your mother think about you going out into a place like this?
Well, she's very anxious, and I think it's just a fear of the unknown at the moment.
Yeah.
Because I'm not quite sure what to tell her about it, because I don't know myself yet.
Yeah.
But I think when she starts receiving letters and understanding what I'm doing out there, then she'll be reassured.
I think so. Do you think that it's going to be like this?
Well, I know for the lads in the hills, I'm sure it will be.
Yeah.
The majority of the time, which is frightening, really.
I know. I mean, yeah. This is a kind of a funny atmosphere even here, isn't it?
Yeah, like training is fine. You're training and it's training for training. Now it's training for the real thing.
Absolutely.
And it's totally different.
I know. Kind of scary. Are you scared at all?
I am frightened, yeah.
Yeah.
But yet I want to go and experience it. So,
yeah.
Like, it's something we have been trained for, so this is it.
My name is Captain Pat McCartan. I'm Weapons Platoon Commander A Company, 68 Irish Battalion, and for the next 6 months I will be your platoon commander in Lebanon. Just to give you a brief on what is going to happen over the next 6 weeks before the first chalk flies from Ireland to Lebanon. The first week basically is composed of administration, getting all your paperwork in order, your wills, your blood groupings, all relevant details that have to be compiled before anybody can fly from Ireland to Lebanon. Also, during this period, you will be concentrating on the use of the personal weapon, just re-honing your skills on the Steyr, Browning pistol and light machine gun. A great deal of emphasis will also be placed on radio work. Most of your work outside here is based on the radio. It's vital that you're able to report accurately, precisely and calmly what exactly is happening so that people can take the appropriate action and come to your aid if necessary.
The radio you have as well, when you're out on an OP in Lebanon and you see something suspicious or anything happens, you want medical assistance or you want backup or you want anything at all out from one location to another, the quickest way to get a message through is on the radio. It's your best friend. It could save your life. So the best way of sending a message and the quickest way is through the radio.
So do we have to be trained on voice procedure to do this, or can we just send a message?
No, well, there's certain procedures for when you're sending on the radio.
Can you give us an example of a message, Serge?
Right, now, I'm going to paint a scenario for you. I'm going to give you an example. You're on an OP, you're overlooking a checkpoint. There's a jeep had to come up to the checkpoint with six SLA in it. I want you to, and they're attempting to break through the checkpoint, so I want you to send a message back to Zero. Okay?
Okay. Right. Hello, Zero. This is 01 Alpha. Message, over. At this location, 14, there are six LA in a jeep attempting to break through the checkpoint. Over.
Attachments!
Attachments!
I just hag is in front!
Hag in front!
Normal four, engage.
Normal four, engage.
Sharon, would you ever be involved like those men there in a medium machine gun?
No, I'd never be involved in any heavy weapons. We've a non-combatant status, which means our personal weapon would be the Steyr. And today we're going to fire it on the range, and Corporal Pluck here is going to instruct me on it.
Well, good.
Well, Sergeant Duggan, the first thing I'm going to do is just give you a few brief characteristics of the weapon, just to, so you'll remember what you've been taught in previous lessons. Then I'm going to show you a few of the safety aspects of the gun that you should know. We have the safety catch here on the side. As you know, as you've been taught, the white means safe, and the red means fire, okay? So before you prepare to fire, you should always have it on the red. If you don't want to fire the gun, have it on the white, the safe. When we're given the order for fire, we bring the weapon up into a firm position, we release the safety catch, we take an aim, and fire. Okay, Sergeant Duggan?
Okay.
Would you like to try it?
Yeah, can I just check with you what the range of the weapon is?
The range of the weapon is 300 metres, up to 300 metres for individual fire. For section fire, 600 metres.
Right.
Any other questions?
No questions.
Okay.
You know, are you not a bit scared now about taking a big gun like that in your hand and letting it off?
Not really. I think we've been instructed so much on the safety of it and how to handle it with live ammunition that we're fairly safe with it, I think.
All right, let's see how you can do.
As we know, Sergeant Duggan, before we hand over any weapon, we have to carry out safety precautions. Clear? Okay, we'll go through that now. Range 200.
Range 200.
At your target in front.
At your target in front.
Fire.
Fire.
Remember, when you squeeze the trigger, don't try not to snatch at it. Just let the round go itself.
Okay.
So we'll try the second round now. Range 200.
Range 200.
Immediate front.
Immediate front.
Fire.
Fire.
That was excellent. That was a much better shot altogether.
Now, what did it feel like, Sharon, firing like that?
Oh, it's great to know there's live ammunition there. It's great.
You think so?
Yeah.
You're quite excited about it.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Well, now, what happens if there's a body down there? How do you feel about that?
Well, I hope there never will be, but if there is, that's just something I'll have to handle. Sir, can you tell me what kind of work I'll be involved in Lebanon?
Yeah, you will be involved mostly in the administration work in Lebanon. You'll be based in Nakoura. Your responsibilities will be towards the what is known as the contingent, the Irish contingent in Nakoura. And for them, you will have to arrange accommodation, feeding, transport. Normal orderly room sergeant skills that you have acquired here. Oh, and you'll also work in your suntan.
Louise and Clancy to come out with very long drawn out, and everybody was very quiet and tired and lonely, you know. But I'm fine now. I mean, I'm more excited now.
How was your mum?
Oh, don't ask. She's very, very upset. Very upset, yeah, she was. She's fine all day, she's keeping up very well. And then near the end, so I made a very quick exit and disappeared, yeah.
So. Is there weeping in Ashingham?
Oh, an awful lot of weeping now. You'd flood out the place now with the weeping that was done. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again.
On behalf of Captain Donohoe and the rest of the crew, I'd like to thank you for flying with Lincoln, and we wish you a very enjoyable and successful stay here in the Lebanon.
So, Shari, we're on the ground.
At last.
What do you think?
Oh, it's beautiful weather. That's the first thing that strikes me anyway.
You're stripping off all the clothes.
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
I think it looks quite good there with all the guys in green, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How many fellows are there about now?
I'd say about 250 to 300.
Yeah. All looking fairly white as
yet. I think the worst of the journey now is over. And
you think so?
Well, I think the plane journey was it. At least we've left Ireland. So that's all I wanted to do.
There's no music and everything, so we can talk.
Okay.
Notice they have made no arrangements for us girls.
No, they haven't. We may make our own arrangements. Just, I think we went before we came out anyway up in the plane. We went a few times to make sure, so we may hold on now at any rate. Well, there were stories, of course, all the way over on the plane, whether or not we'd be left on the tarmac for so long. But really, I suppose I thought my trip would be different and we'd be whisked away very quickly because it was me, of course. But I couldn't believe that this was where we were going to wait. Like, I was expecting nice terminals and maybe a cup of tea or whatever, you know. I mean, I was probably in dreamland, but anyway. So I couldn't believe this was just, you know, where they left us standing. It was really warm, really dense heat.
And a long time.
Over. I mean, it was up to 3.5 hours. I think the normal is 2 hours. But I think we were there up to 3.5 hours, you know. 4 hours, yeah. We're hungry and tired. And, like, it must have been bad for us to just lie down in the tarmac and go to sleep. That must have been really the pits for me, anyway. Like, it's fine going along here now. At least you can get a bit of sleep. And we're on the final leg, more or less. But the countryside and everything is just so like mainland Spain or whatever, you know, just dried up kind of barren land, you know. So at the moment there's nothing to see.
Not really.
No.
But soon we have to get to the border yet, remember?
Yeah, well, now that I want to be awake for. The border's very frightening, but I expected it to be a huge roadway or something. I didn't expect it just to be as small as it was. Like when you said to me, there is the border, I couldn't fathom that at all. You've totally different views on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a bit frightening, like the car being searched and whatever, I mean, from top to bottom and, you know, everything. And they're armed, really armed up there, you know, I mean, this is the real thing.
Good morning. My name is Lieutenant Mellett. I'm the adjutant of the 22nd Irish Component. I'd like to welcome you all here this morning on your first formal parade in Camp Tara. You have a very important job. You will be the personnel that will man UNIFIL headquarters and camp command. And without Nakora camp, the operations of the battalions in the AO would quickly grind to a halt. You provide the personnel for Nakora camp, which is the hub of UNIFIL operations in South Lebanon. And so, I'm confident you'll enjoy your time here just as much as we have. And I wish you every best success in your 6 months here. And now, I'd like to set out in detail the various duties which you will perform in your 6 months here.
Sharon, this is going to be your office?
Yeah, for 6 months. And this is
What's your rank?
Chief McCarthy.
Chief McCarthy, who's going to give me my handover?
Sharon, your main job here will be administration of the camp, the Nacora camp, as well as Camp Tara. All the Irish personnel serving in the camp, and both the FMR elements and the MPKI elements. It's a quite busy job, but once you get into the swing of it, it's quite easy, and the time goes fairly fast once you're busy.
What hours will I be working, and what's the first thing I do in the morning?
Well, you'll finish your morning parade at 7:15, and you'll report straight to the RDM, and you'll collect the morning post for the CO and the other UNIFIL officers, Irish contingent officers. You'll sort out the post, open your mail for the commanding officer, log it into the mail book, take it into the CO. And the rest of the day then will be normal administration routine. You'll have special typing shops for the CO. You'll have two routine orders a week to do. Friday you'll do what we call the Irish routine order. It's for the Irish people serving here. And on Monday you'll do your camp routine order, which gives everyone in the camp any information that is deemed necessary to tell them, i.e. border closings to Israel, etc., changing in administration personnel at civilian level, and things like that.
What are you worried about, Sharon?
I just suppose getting into the swing of things, like, it's just you're at a loose end until you get organised. But once we get into our own stride, we'll be fine.
What's most surprising you at the moment? I mean, this is your first day at work here.
Just, I suppose, the whole different way of life, really. You know, even the hours are just totally different. Just even to get used to starting work at that time, finishing early and meeting everybody and whatever. It's just very strange from at home.
Now, this is my humble abode.
It's going to be for
it's very homey.
Yes, nice, isn't it?
Very
yes.
Nice.
Were you by yourself all the time you were?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I just put in the bed for Sharon for the next 2 weeks.
Oh, I see.
Which means there's great privacy in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's lovely. Yeah. I expect it to be a war-torn hut, you know. This has ruined my whole dream of this.
Yes, because it's got curtains on the window, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Nice bedspread shelves. Did you put in the glass shelves yourself, or were they there?
They were put in for me, I requested them.
Oh, and fridge.
And fridge.
Oh, how wonderful.
Force and Commander's coffee table, taken from the Force Commander's office.
Pinched.
Acquired.
Great. It's feminine.
And
your
wardrobe.
Little desk,
yes.
And your little hangers. And like before the bed was there, I had that chair over there and a little coffee table, and it was all nice. So you can fix it up anyway you
beautiful.
Want. You
can change it around.
You must really
notice,
have a
notice
really
board
homely.
And everything. Yes. So do you think you'll be happy here for 6 months?
Oh, I'll definitely be happy. When I walked in the gate, I knew I'd be happy here.
Because it's Sharon's first trip, everything is going to be new and it's going to be really exciting. And it is the biggest, not the shock, but the nicest surprise Sharon has ahead of her is the fact that the social life is absolutely fantastic out here. She can choose between jogging, aerobics, gym. She can do aerobics at least 3 times a week in the Sweet McCoy accommodation camp where she's going to live. So she's going to live with the Swedish medical company, which is 95% females. So she's not going to have a problem in coping with living with men. There will be about 5% of men living within the same camp as her, but she will have, it'll be an all-female toilets, all-female showers.
How many women?
Approximately 100 nurses.
How many?
Yes, we've got nurses, physiotherapists, pharmacists, nurses' aides. We've got medevac nurses. You've got also one vet, and she takes care of all the animals. And she's also an international bodybuilder in Sweden, so you can get well.
And she'll be listening to things like that all the time as well.
Yes, all the time. All the time. You will soon get used to helicopters, and you will never want to see or hear a helicopter by the time you get home. For the first 2 days, you will look up and have a good look, and after that, you'll be so fed up you won't bother. You will occasionally also have the Israeli jets flying across, but very rarely, but you will have them. But back to your camp, you have all the facilities you could ask for. You've got 2-3 washing machines to choose from, and it's a rotation system. You just write your name and book it a day in advance, and then you've got the privilege of hanging out your washing in the sunshine. One tip, if you've got sexy underwear or very nice bikinis, do not leave them out overnight because they won't be there in the morning. They just won't be there. You've got two discos every single week to choose from, one both in Swedish messes, one at each end of Nakura camp. The one on Friday nights is in Swedmedkoi, where you live. So even if you don't go to the disco, you'll be part of it anyway because you're going to hear it up until 12 o'clock at night, so you might as well go and enjoy it. Unfortunately, you do have to go in uniform. That's the only rule in both in the Swedish mess. You do have to be in uniform. But you can still dance quite good in uniform, so don't mind that. The French have a very nice, it's called, again, social life. They have what's called a dance party, normally twice a month on a Sunday evenings from 6 to 10. The French, De Leon's, very beautiful food, very good music. They're not like the Irish or the other nationalities when they put on a dance, they mean dance. You get in there and you don't get sitting down, you dance for 4 hours. And they're very, very good dancers. And if you don't know how to dance rock and roll now when you've arrived, I can guarantee you'll be able to dance before you go home. And your French will also improve slightly.
So Sharon, first of all, how's your French?
Not very good.
Well, now, secondly, how's your rock and roll?
Not very good either.
So you have two things you're going
two
to learn.
Two things I have to learn.
Okay.
Well, at the moment, we're sitting in glorious sunshine looking at the beautiful blue Mediterranean. But as Sharon is here for a winter trip, she's going to get caught with the rain, the wind, and the wet and the muck. And one discomfort she will have is she has the unfortunate occasion to have to go to the toilet about 3 o'clock in the morning. Because of where her bedroom is situated, she's got about a 3-minute run in between the raindrops to get to the loo. And that will have to be done in rain gear and boots. And it won't be too pleasant at 3 o'clock in the morning, I can tell you, to do that. Like for us, it was the discomfort of swatting the mosquitoes for the duration of the trip. But for her, she'll be dodging the raindrops. And that, by the way, is the Lebanese fishermen. The way they fish, they throw grenades into the water. And then when the fish are dead, they dive in and gather them all up.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling.
We're standing in the veranda of the Blue Beret Club. It's an international club. It is actually in the Irish Camp Tara, but it's an international club because in Camp Tara you have Fijians, Ghanaians, Norwegians and Irish all living side by side next door to each other. So this club belongs to all of them. You also have the French Defence Company coming into this club as well. So Sharon, within the next few weeks, I'm sure, will be very popular in this club as soon as she learns she can sing. So she'll be very busy for the next 6 months, I'm sure. Force Commander's Gate, and we've now entered into what's known as Mingi Street.
This is downtown Nakura.
Which is downtown Nakura. Yeah. And the way we're going to, on this half was called Quality Street, because here you have all the high class, the Lebanese high class restaurants, which are nothing to compare to at home, but here they're the best you can get. Yeah. Here on the street you can get anything from a bar of soap to a Sony CD stack system. Absolutely everything and anything you want. And if you go into a shop and you ask for something and they don't have it, to say, I get it for you tomorrow. And there's always special price for Irish, but don't believe them. You have to learn how to bargain, Sharon. Yeah. You will know how to bargain before you go home.
Sharon, are you good at bargaining?
No, absolutely hopeless.
Yes.
But I think one of the girls with us is very good, so I'll take her shopping. They expect you more or less to bargain.
Yeah. Eat in the restaurants. We have a great time eating in the restaurants.
Well, now tell us a bit about the restaurants. What are they like?
The restaurants, well, okay, they're not restaurants as such here compared to home. We'll say maybe street restaurants like you get a little lower class than you get maybe in Greece or Turkey. But the food is excellent. It's very, very good. You've got Lebanese food, naturally enough. You've got what you call hummus, which is basically just your chickpeas processed into, you know, fine mayonnaise, and it goes very nicely with the Lebanese pita bread. You've also got fattoush tabbouleh, which is all Lebanese salads. And then the two specialised foods out here are fresh fish, which they serve whole. They actually show you the fish, you choose the fish, and then they'll they'll boil it, steam it, whatever, and they'll serve it to you, head and tail and eyes included. And the steaks, there's one restaurant on the street, you are allowed to actually cut your own steak. They place a fillet of steak in front of you, raw, they hand you a knife and they say cut away. And it's the same price whether you take a large one, small one, it's up to you. So you have great fun.
I think perhaps we should describe the street, because listening to you talking about all this, it sounds so grand,
no,
so highfalutin,
no,
and
we're
so
walking,
posh.
No, it's not posh, we're walking past the shacks. Shops, as we call them, have got tin roofs on them. The restaurants, we've got plastic chairs. You're not talking about plush whatsoever. You're talking about your bare necessities. You're talking very little glass. We're talking about, let's say, shack roofs, no air conditioning whatsoever. Very bad conditions for people to work in. The kitchens aren't very well equipped, but they still provide very good meals. But the place is not very well equipped and it's not very plush.
How hygienic is it?
Unfortunately, it's not very hygienic, but as each girl comes along, we pass, we tell them which are the good restaurants, which are the bad restaurants, which are the restaurants to avoid. I know the Irish are always complaining about their potholes. They should come out here. These are real potholes. Absolutely terrible. You know, you really have to watch where you're going, and if you're going to drive, it's less than 6-7 miles an hour.
Now, Sharon, read for me what's written up there on the wall.
Fáil Chicadee Ellie Mini Market. Fáil Chicadee,
like,
yeah. And there's a restaurant as well called Paddy's, I think.
Paddy's.
Yeah, the lads have been there already and say that the girl speaks perfect Irish sayings and she has everything off perfectly. And she absolutely loves the Irish and what they do, the crack, you know. They've heard about the crack out here as well.
When you heard about Mingy Street at home, Sharon, is this what you thought it was going to be like? Mind the dirt there, mind the road.
No, I more or less thought it was kind of a mini shopping centre. I mean, expected, you know. But I mean, I was shocked the first night we came down here. They're actual shacks, you know what I mean? And I was afraid to eat anything from there and until the girls told me where to eat and what was the clean places to eat and whatever. But I mean, it's, you know, it's uncivilised, really. Compared to what we're used to at home, anyway.
Yes, I don't think anybody can realise it until you see it.
No,
really
it's
can't.
Just unbelievable. It's
yeah.
Really, they depend so much, the people, on whatever we buy and whatever, you know.
Yeah.
They really depend on it for their living.
From a distance, the world looks blue and green, and the snow-capped mountains white. From a distance, the ocean meets the stream, and the eagle takes to fly. From a distance.
So, why did you come back?
Well, I must say I found it very difficult to settle out there. It was a very alien place to me at first, but I expected those feelings, so I stayed with them for a while. Before I left, I had an aunt who was very ill, and my mother was nursing her full time, so more or less I was looking after our home place. And it was playing on my mind a lot, and I was worrying a lot about it. So with the circumstances that were in it, I just, after a lot of discussion and consultation and ifs and buts, I just decided it would be better for me to be at home. I was very lonely for home, because of the circumstances I left behind, probably more so than I would normally be. But it made it that little bit harder.
When did you really decide that you wanted to come home? How long had you been there?
I had been there probably into the second week. And I always had the idea in my mind that maybe I would go home, even just for a while on leave or whatever. But it was always there. The thought was always there in my mind.
So it was really there when you went out?
Not really, no. I thought it being a new place and a new job and new, everything being new to me, that I'd be fine, that I would forget things at home more or less and I could leave them behind. But it's just not that easy. In fact, it gets much harder when you're away from home.
Some people might say that you didn't give it enough chance, that you didn't stay long enough there.
People have said that to me, but the way it was with me, I feel that I am mature enough and adult enough to make my own decision. And in my mind, it is the right thing to do. And to me, that's the most important thing. If I was happy with the decision, then it was me that I was going to have to live with whatever consequences came.
Tell me a bit about the procedures you had to go through to come back.
Well, I would have had to see my immediate superior, which would have been my adjutant of the unit.
And you went to see him.
And I went to see him. And more or less, it was him that carried it from there. Mm-hmm. That would be my initial step in the chain of command.
How long would he have talked to you about it? How many times would you have seen him?
Oh, I would have seen him maybe two or three times a day for a few days. And he spoke to me about it and made sure he, as well, was very concerned with the fact that I was making the right decision for myself.
So you just saw him over a period of 3 days?
Yes.
And then he set everything in motion?
Yes.
And how long did that take?
It took only a few days. It was very rapid and done very quickly and most efficient. And I, in the meantime, I had a lot of very good friends over there, and we talked about it all the time, and they gave me their advice, and we discussed the whole thing at length, really, before.
Were you persuaded to stay at all?
Nobody actually asked me to stay, but the whole point always was that I would be sure I was doing the right thing. Because at the end of the day, it's my life and it's me that has to live it. They could carry on with their jobs or whatever, but I'm the one who has to live with whatever decision I had made, whether I had stayed or whether I had come home.
Do you think maybe now that you might have been persuaded to stay?
No. I don't.
No matter what they did?
No. I think I did the right thing for everybody concerned, and most importantly for myself. But I thought about it a lot, and I looked at it from every option. And I thought the best place for me at that time, in the circumstances, was at home, where everything was familiar to me.
At home. But you'd been looking forward to it so much, and talking to earlier on, you know, you were so keen to go, and even when you were there, you sounded fine.
Oh, I was very keen to go. I mean, this is... In the army, Lebanon is built up to be something fantastic, and that if you don't go there, then, you know, what's wrong? Why haven't you been? Or when are you going? Sort of thing. So you catch on to that yourself, announce to yourself, you actually get that bug yourself. Mine came a bit later in life than maybe some of the other females. Mm-hmm. But you actually build yourself up to it. The time to leave for me was very sad. Particularly, believe it or not, within those 2 weeks, I had made lifelong friends who will always be friends to me. And I felt very sad at leaving them. And of course, you feel a certain disappointment within yourself. But yet I knew that what I was doing was right. So it kind of lifted a little. But it was very sad on the day I left, and I was whisked out very quickly so that nobody could really upset me, more or less. Mm-hmm. Everybody was really good to me. But I missed the whole idea of the camaraderie in Lebanon and having all the friends around, and suddenly I was on my own on a plane home.
It must have been quite difficult for you when you went back to work.
It was very difficult for me, and probably I had built up a lot of the problems in my own mind. I was convinced that people would be pointing the finger at me. And it never happened. Everybody was really good to me, and they accepted that it was my decision. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they ask me why, and often I can't answer it. But they did ask. People do ask, and I accept that from certain people, particularly my friends. And a lot of people, I got vindictiveness from a lot of people, which is going to happen anyway. But I was well prepared. I'm a strong person, and I hopefully feel I have just left behind now, and I'm going to continue on with my career.
Did you expect the vindictiveness?
Yes.
Did you?
Yes.
You expect people would say to you, why didn't you stick it out?
Yes, I did expect that, because everybody is different, and some people, in fairness, they couldn't understand why I came home, why I didn't stay there, why I didn't stay overseas. To some people, if you don't do that, if you don't stay overseas and whatever, then you're not really a full soldier, or you're not doing your job to its utmost. And I don't feel that way. I feel I can still carry out my duty, I can still carry on in my career as well, hopefully, as I ever did.
you were home when the war started, right?
Yes.
So what went through your mind at that stage?
I had got to the stage when I came home that if I didn't stop thinking and living in the past, that I couldn't carry on in my job. So I had to put it behind me, and I had to put any thoughts of Lebanon behind me and just continue on. As they do at the end of 6 months as well, they have the same problems. They have got to say it's over now and continue into their normal work. And I had to do that for myself because I couldn't live in the past, and I couldn't live with thinking that everybody was going around pointing the finger and saying she came home from Lebanon kind of thing. So I didn't, as much as possible, I didn't think about Lebanon.
From a distance, we are instruments marching in a common band, playing songs of hope, playing songs of peace. They're the songs of every man. God is watching us. God is watching us. God is watching us from a distance.
Do you ever in your sort of inner self say to yourself, I wish I'd stayed?
Of course, I have to say that to myself, particularly at this time, because now they're coming home. And you'll always say, it should have been me. But if I have to live my life with ifs and buts and would-bes, then there's nobody going anywhere. I have to go forward.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.